session number 16808, room 4.
Great Spittle's real form.
And so you got to know characters of people, you see, and the other ranks used to get to know the characters of all the NCOs. And you had these sort of NCOs who felt the only way they could get things done was threatening to put somebody on a charge, which I thought was rather a weak, you know, way to do it. So my method used to be, and the lads, the new lads, soon were informed casually, because they naturally they say, what's he like? You see, because the troop corporal was the one NCO in a tank troop that lived with the troopers or other rank. I mean, you didn't have all troopers. I mean, Eddie Pantelow, he was another corporal in my troop, but he was junior to me in respect that he was only corporal because he was the troop leader's driver. I was the troop corporal. I was a troop corporal tank commander. He was a corporal driver, you see. So my rank came next to the sergeant in authority, and that rank was respected irrespective of what other ranks other people held within the troop, you see. So you lived with the boys, as we called them, and the sergeant had their own mess and the officers naturally theirs, you see. So they were only with the troop in the daytime or in an official capacity, but you were there all the time. So when you got new intakes and they come in and you got three or four new blokes in your troop, you see, almost one of the first things they went in, they said, what's he like? Because they come from a training regiment where discipline was very strict, where they had to do, if they didn't do what the NCO told them, they was in trouble, you see. And the first thing I want to know is, what sort of an NCO they got? What's he like? And the lads used to say, well, old Reggie's all right. You know, the only thing is, if he tells you to do anything, you better do it. I say, well, is he like that? No, he's not like that at all. But if he tells you to do anything, if he wants you to do anything, do it. That was the only explanation they got, you see. So out of curiosity, you sometimes got one chanced his arm, as you might say. And I'd say, right, well, I'm not having that. And I don't put people on a charge. You'll pray behind the guard tonight with your big pack, blancoed, brassos polished, button all it all cleaned out, back and front, 6 o'clock behind the guard. Oh, it's your Mr. Lorry, you see, the passion wagon, because that went at 5 o'clock. And that was their punishment. They were stuck in camp for that night. They lost that night in the town. So they didn't have any black mark on their army character, but they'd been punished. And to me, that was as bad a punishment and more worthwhile, and it got me respected as an NCO, rather than the bloke who got a reputation of saying, yeah, well, he put you on the charge, as soon as look at you. He got no respect, other than the fact that he'd got a rank. They respected his rank. They did not respect him, and that's what I always felt I had, by never having to put a man on a charge, but always having authority to get him to do what I wanted, you see. So, rightly or wrongly, you know, it's just a matter of opinion, I suppose. But anyway, we was up at Little Driffield. I was guard commander, and it coming up to changing the guard time, you see, and I was... What we used to, because the lights are going out, so we started lighting hurricane lamps, you see, because we got torches, electric torches and that, but you had to have a light permanently, so you had the old hurricane lamps, you see. So we're lighting up the old hurricane lamps and all that sort of thing. And I'd look down the book, see who was in, like, you know, and who was eight, and because you got to know the character of the lads who skived and who didn't. I wonder, skived off, you know, got a young lady down the town or something, you see. And then I used to look down and I think, well, again, if the book was checked and the bloke wasn't in, he was on a charge the next morning, you see. And I used to look down and I think, right. So I used to apply my own discipline, you see. So If you'd have asked anybody in a regiment who knew me, they'd say, well, when Reggie's guard commander, everybody's in, you see. But I used to exact my own punishment in my own time with the ones that didn't come in. I'd go and see the sergeant, and I'd tell him, I won't, so-and-so, I won't be on the guard tonight, Sarge. And they, again, knew me. They wouldn't question why I wanted him beyond the guard. It was sufficient that I'd asked for him to be beyond the guard. And I'd leave it to the sergeant to say what he got to do beyond the guard. I mean, he could just simply parade as he was. Sufficient for him to be there, knowing he would miss the Liberty Lorry, as I used to call them, and then the passion wagon that come later on, you see. That was his punishment. Or the sergeant, his own sergeant might think, ah, yes, here's a chance for me to get a bit of my own back. And they make him parade with something, you see. They'd probably say, go down the armoury, collect a rifle, and parade behind the guard with it, so they'd inspect that rifle to see if it was clean and all that, you see. And then they'd take it back, hand it back in again, you see. Anything they could do for punishment, you know, rather than put him on a charge, you see. So that was my way. And so this particular night, we got everything ready for the last change of guard before I put all the lights out. And suddenly the door flies open, and what they used to do for the blackout, they had the door of the Nissen hut, and then you had about 4 feet built in, you see, timber, and then a blanket hanging down to the floor with a piece of wood across the bottom, so it hung straight, you see. And then in the daytime, you rolled it up and tied it up out of the way. And at night, you just undone it and let it drop down to the floor. So you opened the door, you stepped into a little cubicle, pushed the blanket aside and stepped into the room, you see. And so it didn't upset the blackout. And assume you shut the door behind you, see, before you move the blanket. And so we're all ready for this last, got the lights all ready. I'm going to change the guard, and then I'm going to turn the lights out, you see. And suddenly the door flies open, up goes the blanket, in comes Tom. Now he was always 3/4 drunk. I never ever saw him drunk, didn't matter how much he drank, he was never drunk, but he'd always had enough and he was aggressive with it. He comes in, you see, and initially he can't see, come out the dark. And as his lights get right, he looks at him, he said, and he sees who's sitting there, the guard commander. And I could always rub him up the wrong way by being proper. So I turned the book round. I said, you want to see the book, sir? You see. And he was up in a flash. Knocked it on the floor, the book, across the floor. And he said, I don't need to look at that. He said, when you're guard commander, he said, every effing person's in, he said, with no exception, he said. Right, he says. So I said, well, I'm sorry about that, sir. I said, but they were all in. He said, they all effing well are, he said, you know. And out he goes. And I goes out and changes the guard, so you're thinking of 5, 10, 15 minutes perhaps. Changes the guard. And of course, the lads are all awake because we just changed the guard, you see. The new guard, the old guard's come in and all that, you see. And it's not late enough for people to want to get their heads down properly, you know. And we still got some grub left, probably, from the cookhouse. So we're sitting there, you see. And I said, right, I better go put the lights out. So it takes me torch, you see, goes across the yard, as we called it, goes in the pump house, lifts the valve, chunk, 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 out go all the lights, you see. Goes back in the guard room, and we're sitting there, you see, and suddenly, bang goes the door, up goes the blanket, in comes Tom, in his long johns, you see, like a prize fighter from years ago, that's their telephone. And he storms in, you see, got his socks on, got his socks on and his long johns, you see, storms in, he said. He said, what do you think you're doing? He said, pulling a light out. So I said, it's turned 12 o'clock, sir. I know that, he said. Look, you knew, he said, I hadn't had time to get into bed, he said, you know, before you put the lights out, or, you know. So I said, never gave it a thought, sir. God, he effed and blind at me. He was furious. He done everything bar hit me, sort of thing, you know.
Had you learned deliberately?
Aye?
Had you learned deliberately?
No, it was the time, you see. But Tom and I had always had this animosity. If it had been another guy commander, he wouldn't have come down. But it was me, you see. And he didn't look at the time. And another day, another time, he would probably have apologised afterwards. But anyway, he was angry. So anyway, he knew he was going to get nowhere. And of course, the lads are sitting and he can see I'm grinning, like you see. And you can add insult to injury without saying anything. And he's boiling. And he don't know what to do. And he wants to get at me. He wants to take me and, you know. So all of a sudden he says, right, I'll tell you something now. I said, well, that'd be nice, sir. Look, don't be funny, he said. But I'm just going to tell you something. And whether he was ever sorry for it, I don't know. But he said, on my desk is a list, he said, of recommended promotions. Promotions, he said. He said, and your name is down for your other stripe. He said, but you're at it. Off. You can forget it. Right? So I says, entirely up to you, sir. I said, if I wasn't going to be paid for it, I said I shouldn't have had it in the first place. I shouldn't have accepted it. Well, he said, you needn't be funny. He said, but you've had it. And off he went, you see. Well, that was that, you see. So I remained troop corporal. There was a sequel to this, because eventually we go to Normandy and we get casualties. And after about 2 or 3 weeks, I'm still troop corporal, and circumstances are changed, you see, because we're getting now casualties and stripes are being thrown about because it's got to be that way. And old Bill Bailey, who was our technical storeman, he used to do like, I don't know if you know, but you have an A echelon in the forces. You have a B echelon, which, as you probably know, is where all your supplies and stuff is kept at the rear. Travels with you to the regiment, you see, but it's B echelon. But in between that and the fighting part is the A echelon. And they are the people that are responsible for bringing up from the B echelon to the tanks everything the tanks require to carry on the next day's fighting, whether it's petrol, ammunition, food, somebody's burnt a top coat, you want a new top coat, or your boots, or, you know, anything that's needed. Because towards the end of the day, the troop officer asks the sergeant and the corporal, anything you want, you see. And they say, because they don't mean ammunition or petrol. You deal with that when the lorries come up, you see. You ask the tech storeman what you want, ammunition, petrol wise, you see. They want to know other things, you see. So you just tell them what you want. And he refers that back to B echelon. That is put into the A echelon. And when the A echelon comes with your routine petrol and ammunition and that sort of stuff, then there's additional things that are put on to come to, you see. And this particular night, because it's always at night time, you see, they don't pull the tanks out till it's night time. Don't you disengage from the enemy if they can, you see, to do this for this purpose. And Bill Bailey comes up, and we've been in action about 3 weeks, and casualties were going on and things like. And he says, hey, Reg, he says, 3 stripes. See, gives me these sergeant stripes. So I said, well, you can take them back, Bill. Or you can tell Tom, if I wasn't good enough in Yorkshire, I'm not good enough now. Tell him to stuff up. He said, he won't like it. I said, I don't care what he likes. So he, that was that, you see. Well, then, I don't know whether it was a few days or a week or what, but stuff comes up the A echelon, and Bill Bailey comes round again. He says, yeah, he said, you do what we like with these. I'm not taking them back, he said. But Tom sent them up. He said, you've got to have three stripes. So I said, he insisted on giving them to me, you see. So I said, well, you can tell Tom I've got them, but I shan't use them. I said, and tell him it's nothing to do with Yorkshire now. It's self-preservation. I said, and I shall never wear them. I chucked them away. Well, the circumstances that I, in my mind, I'd arrived at was that we were having blokes made up and given stripes who I knew personally, and that when they were came to Normandy, it was probably an unpaid Lance Corporal wireless operator, or he hadn't got any stripes at all. But positions had to be held, and so people were given stripes of rank that they were not trained for. That was what I felt, my opinion. And I was prepared to accept the fact that rather than travel as a troop sergeant with my point tank, as it usually was, the troop corporal in front, and it was usually that tank that found the enemy first because he got knocked out, you see. And I felt that I was sufficiently experienced now, after say a month or 6 weeks getting on in action, you began to get this feeling of trouble. You could get a sense of trouble. And I thought, I'm going to be safer as a troop corporal, relying on my own instincts, than have a corporal in front of me who hadn't got those instincts. And I'd got three stripes, which I'd still got to go 3 months for before I could apply for them to be paid. So if I got killed as wearing three stripes, I'd be a corporal. I wouldn't be a sergeant, you see. So, that was my thinking the second time. So I told Bill, I said, tell Tom, I'm not bothered about them. I said, I should never wear them. I said, and it's nothing to do with Yorkshire. And old Bill said, what's this bloody Yorkshire? I said, Tom knows, you see. This was between me and Tom. And so I never wore them. I was a troop corporal, you see. Now, when the war finished, we had an incident then in the Operation Goodwood. I don't know if you know about these operations. It lasted 2 days, 18th and 19th of July. And about tea time, on the second day, we'd taken Borgibus Ridge, the forces, British, like the 3rd Tank Regiment and the 2nd Yeomanry and the 8th Rifle Brigade, between them, had taken Borgibus Ridge at the end of the day of the 19th of July. And we were sitting there waiting for the counterattack to come, because Germans always counterattacked. We would never do that. Normally the British thing was, you have an objective and you take it, you consolidate, you see. Well, if you don't take it, you get pushed out. 9 times out of 10, the thing was to sort of lick your wounds, have a think about it, and do something later on. But the Germans didn't seem to do that. They seemed to go back and think, bugger that, we ain't having that. And they used to come back pretty quick. So we were sitting up there expecting a counterattack. And sure enough, it came in. And it was preluded by artillery fire, shell fire of some sort. I mean, it might have been just 88s on the tanks, the Tiger tanks, I don't know. But it was shell fire that was coming in. And one shell landed on the back of my tank, just beyond a turret. Blew everything off that was shiftable, like toolboxes, mud guards, and everything. Cleaned the turret. I mean, the turret had got nothing left on it at all. And all the covers over the engine were blown off. And what we used to do, what we learned, and I don't say ever, now, when I say what we used to do, I speak as a personal, because units and individuals did individual things in tanks that didn't apply perhaps to the next tank, you see. You did things that you learned for your own benefit. And what we did, we put two sacks of sand, of soil, on the turret behind the tank commander's head, you see, because snipers were killing tank commanders left, right and centre, you see. Well, when you open the flaps on a Cromwell, they opened up in two halves, except it was a circle. So your head is in a rifle sighting. But if you put two sacks of earth behind your head, you're in three sides of a box, provided that turret, and you had a cupola turret, which is independent to the main turret, you see. So the tank commander could swing round and look around anywhere he liked without moving his turret, you see. And you had like little handlebars inside and handles on like bicycle brakes, you see. You pulled them down and you swung it round and looked anywhere you liked, but you never moved your turret, you see. But as long as you're at what we call number 12, as the turret is built, your head is in three sides of a box, you see, to give you a bit of added protection. Well, everything had gone, you see. And all I felt as though somebody come up and tapped me on the head. And I thought, and I realised I was dazed, I was a bit concussed. You know, I sort of blinked and thought, a bit hazy. And this, I thought, bloody hell was that? And I sort of, not unconscious, I sort of lowered myself down on my seat and sat there for a minute. I thought I'd gather my senses a bit. I looked across over the top of the gun, over the breech, and Bill Bagley, my wireless operator, the lad who come from Birmingham, he thought I talked funny. He's sitting there like, and got his head in his hands. And there's all blood coming down through his fingers, you see. I said, and I've done what we never used to do. I reached across, and of course the breech, because I mean if your gun goes off, you're going to lose your arm, you see. I reached across and shook him, and he sort of looked up. I said, bloody hell's happened. He said, all right, we've been hit. He said, what's happened to you? And I looked, my hands are all blood, you see. So I'm looking down, and Denny Wells, my gunner, now my knee should never have got hurt at all. My gunner is down there, and he's crouched down with his head in his hands. And he's sitting in front of me, below me, you see, in the pit of the turret. So I nudges him with my foot, and he sort of leaned back, sort of fell back. His eyes open, looking up at me, and he's all covered in blood. And the three of us in the turret were all wounded with shrapnel and blast from this shell would have dropped just behind the turret on the back of the tank, you see. Well, it totally immobilised the tank as an operative vehicle. The engine wasn't damaged in any way. The co-driver and the driver were perfectly all right, you see. And I'm gathering my senses a bit, I goes across to our troop officer, Mr. Dolby, Lieutenant. He got, I'm still in, now this is, I don't want to diverse if I can help it. He went missing, presumed killed, down at Via, a fortnight or 3 weeks later. But he was my troop officer. I went across to his tank, climbed on it, and told him what had happened. He said, well, he said, this lot's finished here, he said, we just had on the radio, he said, but they're going to pull us out, you see. It was in the evening, this was, you see. Sort of 6 o'clock time, probably. He said, they're going to pull us out, you see, because the rifle brigade and that felt like the situation was contained, you see. And across the valley, because at Goodwood, we was up on a ridge, and there's a valley about 3 miles across. And these railways running across it, and this big railway, well, this bank about 30 feet tall. And the other side, in the distance, we could see the Cromwells of the 7th Armoured Division. Because air brigade of tanks, the three armoured regiments, that was the 3rd Royal Tanks, 23rd Hussars, 2nd 5th and 4th Yeomanry, were all Shermans. We were the only Cromwell regiment, because we officially were the Heavy Armoured Reconnaissance Regiment for the division, you see. But after Epsom, Pip Roberts now was using us as a 4th Tank Regiment, and he said he had no need, and he'd borrowed a squadron of armoured cars from the, I think it was the old cavalry, one of them, who were armoured cars, you see, and he'd borrowed a squadron which he kept with him for the rest of the campaign, of the Normandy campaign, you see, and used us predominantly, most of the time, as a 4th Armoured Regiment, you see. And it was a good idea in a way, because he could now use the 3rd Royal Tank Regiment, which he nearly always put us with them, 3rd Royal Tank Regiment, 2nd Yeomanry, and put them with, say, one of the battalions of the infantry, and he got a battle group. And it also got the 2nd 5th and 4th of Yeomanry, 23rd Hussars, another battalion from the infantry, and he got another battle group. So from then on, it was operating 2 battle groups instead of a single tank brigade. It was very good thinking, really. But anyway, that's what we were doing at this time, you see, operating with the 3rd Tanks as a battle group, and with the 8th Rifle Brigade. Well, we goes across to the 7th Armoured Division, because all I'd done then, you see, I went to Benny, the driver, Ben, a Cockney lad. I said, "Benny, get your head up," so he accommodated. Like, so I said, "See the 7th Armoured Division across the valley?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, get across amongst them," I said, "because we're going to get, you know," I said, "get some to do something for their tank, you see, get them to repair it, like, you see." He said, "Oh, right, I read." So with no further communication, he just drives across in his own good time and his own choosing, and we goes across to them, you see. Well, without going into all the details, they fixes us up. We spend the night with Brigade HQ because we didn't know where the yeomanry had gone, and the next day we rejoined the regiment. The weather broke and it poured a rain, and that night we had some shelling or whatever, and I got wounded again where we was resting, you see, on the night, during the night of the 20th of July. Consequently, I went in hospital. Now, in the time I was in hospital, tank commanders were becoming very scarce, and they weren't sending them back to England with casualties. They were keeping them and trying to deal with it, you see. So in my medical thing, in my book, I appealed at one time about a pension, you see, and they, when there's an appeal, they send you all your medical history right away from when I was a terrier, you see. And this incident in there, when I came out of hospital, it says there, this man, to return to his unit, recommended 14 days light duties. And we're in Normandy. Now, how could I get 14 days light duties if they'd returned me to the regiment? When I get back to the regiment, they don't want anybody on light duties. They want a tank commander. So I'm back in my tank, you say. I'm back as troop corporal. Well, I was away from that night of the 20th, and I returned to the regiment during the night of the 29th of July, and during the night of the 30th of July, and the morning, and coming up to the 31st, you see. Well, that was the day that we started our next major action, which was Bluecoat, the 31st of July. At that time, the 30th of July, the 2nd Yeomanry were in reserve to the division, and they started their actual fighting on the 31st, which was their first day of Bluecoat, you see. And I rejoined them and became troop corporal again. Well, what had happened, and this is explaining why I refused my 3rd stripe, you see, and remained a troop corporal. When I gets back, it's during the night, you see, of the 30th, in the dark, and I'd collected a Cromwell from the delivery squadron, because when you come out of hospital, they don't take you from hospital back to your regiment. You have to go to a holding unit, and then you go to another holding unit, and then I went to this tank delivery squadron, and I stayed with them a night, and then the next night, lieutenant, he was in charge of this unit, and what he did, he built up a convoy of vehicles, not all track vehicles, some were wheeled, and where this unit wanted such a vehicle, and that unit wanted such a vehicle. That was in his column, you see. And he'd unlock a Cook's tour. That regiment, that regiment, that regiment. And each time, dropped off a vehicle that they wanted. So when he gets to the yeomanry, he drops me off. I'm driving, on my own, nobody with me, you see, because I'm only following the vehicle in front. It didn't need anybody else. With a Cromwell, as Cromwell tank, you see. And because I was going to be returned to my unit, because they'd found out I was a tank commander.